Good morning and welcome to the Morning Voice. We appreciate you joining this morning as we do every day of the week. Five hosts on the Morning Voice, five different days, five different topics, a little bit of politics, more on a couple of the days, Tuesdays and Wednesdays, but hopefully a great conversation to brighten your current drive, which today may have been brutal.
Today might not be very bright.
I just came rolling into the studio just a few minutes ago, and Matt luckily had the door open, and I could get right to the chair. Huge accident out over at Miracle Mile. Looked like a head-on, Matt. Miracle Mile and La Cañada, and in of all odd things, it was basically shutting down traffic on three different lanes. And luckily, I think the officers that were working the scene realized you had to keep some of the traffic flow, so you literally had to weave between the two cars to go westbound on Miracle Mile.
Wow. But,
it's like you said yesterday, it looked like the traffic was going crazy.
It's I've just noticed in the last week or so, I've just noticed in the last week or so that just the traffic volume in Tucson, just driving around town in the afternoons, and maybe because most of it is I'm out in the mornings and I get home, I'm here in the mornings, and then I work my way home. But boy, oh boy, it just seems like the last week or so the traffic volume on the roads in the afternoons has been noticeably higher.
I think it hits everything. I think the winter, obviously we get the snowbirds back, and with the late temperature drops, so they may be delaying their return to the area. That's got something to do with it. The lack of sun. So as our nights get longer, you have more people during rush hour traffic in the dark.
True.
We still have problems with pedestrians, as highlighted just unfortunately in Marana. We've got a lot to do on the infrastructure and the traffic control around this place. There's no doubt about it.
I don't know Moore and Sanders, but it doesn't seem like a very pedestrian. I mean, Moore and Ever Valley and Sanders doesn't seem like a really pedestrian friendly area. So I would imagine Moore and Sanders would be maybe even less so.
Be careful out there.
Gosh,
the Morning Voice on Tuesday, civic engagement. It's all about trying to get you involved. We are a nation of rights, responsibilities, and freedoms. And there's so many ways you can serve your country, serve your community, serve your neighborhood, serve your families. There's a lot of different ways to do it. And today, we're going to highlight a couple different avenues on how to get that. We're going to have Dr. Teresa Hill with Tucson Values Teachers with us this morning to talk about their most recent event and how they're trying to support teachers out in the community to make their lives better and give them an upper hand on teaching the next generation. And then the second hour, we're going to talk about water. There's been a lot of conversation about water. Matter of fact, Matt sent me an article that we'll save to tease the beginning of the water hour at 8 o'clock. But we're also going to have Ted Cook, longtime general manager of the Central Arizona Project, a recent nominee by President Trump to take over the Bureau of Reclamation, which is who manages the water that's on the Colorado River. That would have been a huge win for Arizona, I believe, although I do know Ted personally, and he would be absolutely fair to both the upper and lower basin states. But what I do know is he understands the river as well as anyone. And in the world of politics, a couple weeks after he was nominated, that nomination was pulled after some complaints from, my belief, the Colorado and Utah senators. So,
okay.
So we're going to have a good conversation with him on that and what's what things on the river looks like right now. But there was big news yesterday.
Okay.
Big news. First off, last week we skipped our sports conversation early, and this was one heck of a weekend for University of Arizona.
Yeah, actually we covered that in the, excuse me, I'll get on the mic here, but we covered that on the news yesterday. It was a big weekend starting on Friday. With the little basketball action.
Big basketball victory. You can't ask for anything more from that one,
I mean, longtime rivals dating back to Pac-10 days.
Oh, yeah.
And Pac-12 and, but longtime rivals, UCLA and U of A played I'm using the air quotes because we're on the radio,
the neutral site
game, which was less than 15 miles from their home court of Pauley Pavilion. So,
Well, remember last year's neutral site was in Phoenix. Now maybe 90 miles,
well,
but I tell
100
you,
miles.
Katie and I were
that's
there.
100 miles away. That's a little different.
Katie and I were there, but I would not call it neutral.
No,
it was
of course
absolutely.
Not.
So I think this is what a lot of these teams are going to play these big games. They don't want it in a true. I mean, we played up in Vegas. just a couple weeks ago. You're seeing a lot bigger matchups between big schools, big rivalries, as well as some of the top teams in the nation. But they're trying to put them on neutral sites. Yeah, the neutral site give and take. Yeah, not really.
Well, programs don't want to go to another program. You know, one program doesn't want to go to a hostile court.
Absolutely.
And so I think that's their reluctance. So you can still get a good matchup, but they say, look, we're not going to do it at your home court.
And the good thing about the U of A, you go out to Los Angeles.
Yeah,
there's a lot.
No, they turned out. You could hear them.
U of A fans. Yeah. There's no doubt.
So then that was a slugfest. I mean, I didn't see the whole game, but I saw the second half, and that was a slugfest. There were lead changes, huge momentum shifts.
You mean you missed the slow start?
Are you being sarcastic? No,
yes, I'm being very sarcastic. Okay. Yeah. I'm not sarcastic. It's truthful.
Wait, what?
The one thing we don't do well so far this year is get out of the gate quickly. We fell behind real fast.
Oh, okay.
And Del Orso came off the bench and immediately hit like three threes and contributed. And so it was a back and forth game throughout, but big swings.
What I saw was like all these lead changes, the momentum. You could just see the momentum going from one team to the other and back. And it was what I saw of it in the second half, it was a great game to watch.
So my question for you, Katie and I were traveling, and so we were watching it on the phone and listening to it through the radio on the phone and all that. I didn't get to see, was Cronin as usual, Cronin, UCLA's coach?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean,
he's not a Bobby Hurley type to watch. Bobby's just so animated. It really fires everybody up. But Cronin just always looks like he's angry.
Yeah, it's a good place to be, I suppose, as a basketball coach. You never be happy with, you could be winning by 10 points and you need to find something to critique your team on. But of course, you know, and he still does the jacket, the jacket and tie. Staff does too.
They all look professional.
I did see one of the, which I hate in-game sideline report. I just loathe. Okay. Is that a strong enough word? I loathe in-game sideline reporters. Football, basketball, you know, tennis, curling. I don't care. I don't like it. So anyway, that's that. But the gal that was doing this, and I don't know who it was, but she's talking to Mick during coming out of one of the timeouts or something. And she said something about there was some sharp passing or sharp play. And he says, the only people, he was, you know, again, a coach is always riding his team. So he's like, the only people are out here who are dressed sharply or something like that, or you and possibly me.
The irony is, as you said, the problem I've got with those sideline reporters is they're always just the most dumb questions you could ever ask. So, coach, do you think your team needs to pick it up here? You're down by eight. Well, duh. Come on. What are you saying?
I think it was Jed Fish a few years ago during a football game, obviously, and they come to him at the end of the first, well, what are you going to try to do here? Well, we're going to try to score. And I'm like, you know.
All of a sudden, Matt Neely's going, hey, maybe I could coach the U of A. That's the strategy I need to come up with.
We're going
to
try to get a touchdown.
I can do that.
What's your strategy, coach? Get more points than the other team. Anyway, but then Saturday, the Cats go to Ohio. They go to Cincinnati and against a ranked team. And it was, again, there were some lead shifts, lead changes, momentum changes. But the Cats prevailed, and they got it out a victory in Cincinnati and beat a ranked team and got their seventh win. And so from here on out, they're playing with house money. Every game they win, they kind of improve their bowl lot.
One game that you wouldn't be able to say that they could have won.
Sure.
That's the one game, you need to go get the door for our guest?
No, not yet.
Did
I miss it?
No. Okay. I saw you looking on the glass like, something's coming up. But the Iowa State game was really the only game
that was the blowout. We
didn't play well.
Sure.
Every other game we were in, yeah, could have won.
Every
and
one of them.
If you had started the season saying we're going to be 7-3 at this point,
I would have said, give me some of that.
Give me some of that.
Some of whatever you're smoking. That's what I would have said.
And you know what? I guess when you have a good season, you get rewarded.
I think we've spoken about this before, but what I really like about them, they don't give up. They play to the end. And yeah, they came up short a couple of times, BYU and what was the other, Houston, I guess. The BYU and Houston game were a little, had a tough ending, but you know, they stick with it, and they've got a lot of heart. Oh, and the other thing that happened is Noah Fifita passed Nick Foles and Willie Tuitama as the top number of touchdowns.
Yeah, you think about that. What an is such an incredible accomplishment. Yeah. And apparently, apparently that stadium just got rewarded.
Yeah. Yes, they did. That was
$60 million
naming rights deal.
$60 million dollars over 20 years. Definitely one of the biggest. Now, if you look at, I did a lot of looking into what the other stadiums from the Big 12 were named. This is going to be a momentum. You're going to see this happen. It's going to happen all over the place. But I'll give Desiree Reed Francois a lot of credit. That's a good big deal, and it's with a local partner.
Yes.
The question, Matt, and what we've got to have the listener start thinking about is, what are you now going to call the stadium? Now, it's Casino del Sol Stadium. I think mm-hmm. you're going to hear that starting this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you have to have some nickname, and I've heard maybe call it the Soul. But we'll see where people play with it. I heard there was texting and other things going on yesterday that were saying, are we going to now put slot machines in the restrooms? Are we going to leverage this? But the fact of the matter is, Casino del Sol, a product of the Pascayaki tribe, has been a big partner with the university and in this region for a long time. So I think if we're going to name it, and we're going to name it after a company or an organization, I am really glad to see that we named it local. It's got a big impact to us. The fact that casinos in the name, other people will recognize who the partner is, should hopefully help the Pascayaki tribe advertise. They've got the new Casino del Sol that's going to be opening up actually inside the boundaries of the city of Tucson. So there's a lot to go on. So it really was a big event, and it's a good thing, I think, for them going forward.
It is, absolutely. Again, it is the, sorry to take a call, but that's the reality of the game right now.
Yeah.
It's basically development pro
league. It is.
And it is what it is. I mean, it's an interesting development, but it's not a surprise, right?
No.
I mean, they've made this clear for the last year or so. That was one of the things that Desiree Reed Francois said when she took over, that was coming.
Right? Absolutely. And I think it's the future. And I think there was only one out there that has a bigger number, but it hits over more years. So
yeah.
So it's they did well on it, and it's local, and it's supporting local. We're still local. We're still the University of Arizona, and I think it's going to have a good impact, and we'll see.
Right.
Good. Congratulations to Casino del Sol and the Pascayaki tribe on doing it. And to the university for finding another way to augment the rising cost of athletics.
The face of college athletics has changed for better or worse. You know, I'm a little bit traditional in that, but whether you like it or not, it's changed. And the other thing is, let's hope, Ted, that that new source streams of revenue eliminate these fees that these kids are being charged.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
We got to figure something out. We know that in a lot of fronts. So, well, we appreciate you staying with us for the first segment. Dr. Teresa Hill from Tucson Values Teachers will be in studio with us when we return. You're listening to The Morning Voice on 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk station. Stay with us through the break.
I'm going to actually get something queued up here to play because I've just been having so much fun, Ted.
Well, that's good. That means we were on a roll this morning, Matt. That's how it's supposed to be. Well, the thing is, back there, you have so many responsibilities. You've got to answer the phone. You have to answer the door. You've got to cue the music. You've got to keep me on time and on target, which is not always easy.
Because one thing I'm not
doing, we blew right past this one.
One thing I'm not doing, I'm not shaking.
You're not shaking.
I'm not shaking.
All right. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely's behind the glass, keeping me on time, on target, even if we went a little overboard on that first one. So I'm going to get right to our guest for the next almost 40 minutes, Dr. Teresa Hill. And Dr. Hill, I've actually worked with you for about 2 years now, coming up on 2 years at Tucson Values Teachers, because Tucson Values Teachers is actually officed in the SALC office space. I got to tell you, I did not know how impressive your resume was.
Oh, thank you so much, and thank you for having me here.
Well, I greatly appreciate you being here. I obviously look forward to hearing you talk more about Tucson Valley's teachers, but I do want to point out some of your history, and then you can tell us how it brought you to Tucson Valley's teachers. But you started as a math teacher and a dance teacher at Flowing Wells High School.
I did.
And you eventually became the assistant principal. Well, we can hit that because that's when you put the hammer down and you made people start to get to class on time.
That's right.
But you then opened Walden Grove High School down in Sarita.
Correct.
School district as the principal there. And throughout that time, you then, after that, worked as the deputy director of the Arizona Educational Foundation.
Correct.
And eventually you're still, and are you still teaching at the NAU?
I am. I currently have a class right now.
Okay. Yes. I saw that. And you took over Tucson Valley's teacher in January of 2024. And we'll get to that. But as I looked through the numerous awards, the 2021 National Association of Secondary School Principals, Arizona Principal of the Year.
Yes, sir.
That's a big deal. You've been awarded the Hispanic Sports and Academic Enrichment Administrator there. You've done so many things. But did you really develop a dance team at Flowing Wells that went on to like 4 state championships?
I did.
And appeared on America's Got Talent?
So actually my kids, when I was teaching, we started with, you know, no dance program. And if you know Flowing Wells, you know, there really isn't a big area of dance studio dancers. And so we had the opportunity to just build something really special with those kids. And we did get to where we had 4 state championships and we were competing at the national level every year, making the top 5 in the last few years. That would be like the big nationals. It's called UDA, Universal Dance Association. Okay. But in 2002, we actually won the NDA National Championship. So it was a lot of fun.
How did America's Got Talent get into your resume?
Yeah, so when I transitioned into administration, went over to Walden, just because dance was, you know, special to me, I asked the superintendent, Dr. Valenzuela, hey, can I bring dance? He's like, of course you can. So I brought dance. You know, I learned one thing from Dr. Karen Blair is always surround yourself with great people. And I knew Christy Lopez was teaching kindergarten in Sahuarita, and I knew her sister. They both very strong dancers. And so I reached out to Christy, said, hey, come join me. Convinced her to come over to the high school level. And, she just did amazing things. And we kind of, you know, all I had to do is kind of throw little ideas in her head. And then she did the work. So the kids were amazing. They, you know, they did themed routines.
Yeah.
And, you know, they went viral. And then after that, you know, America's Got Talent reached out.
Oh, they reached out to you?
They reached out to us. We didn't have to audition. And they said, we'd love to have you on the show. Kids made it all the way to the finals. So they were on you know, about 3 or 4 times on America's Got Talent.
Yeah. Did not know that.
Yeah.
So you've got an incredible background, you know, from both administrative side, because like I kind of joked about you getting people on time, but you reduced the tardiness rate when you became the assistant principal and focused on it down by 58%.
Yes.
So that's significant. So you also have that love for the kids, the passion, but you also had the ability to get firm when you needed to, and obviously great success at Walden Grove. But what brought you to Tucson Valley's teachers?
Yeah, so after 30 years of, you know, being an educator, and once I hit retirement, I wasn't ready to completely retire. I had the opportunity to go to Arizona Educational Foundation, and so that nonprofit is statewide, focused on public schools, and so I took the opportunity to do that. And being in that nonprofit world when Tucson Valley's teachers opened up, I just thought, what better opportunity to come and make an impact in my community, in my area. You know, I'm not originally from Tucson, but I feel like I'm a Tucsonan. I've been here over 30 years and have a lot of connections and just thought, this is a great opportunity. Might as well throw my name in the hat.
So where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Las Cruces, New Mexico.
Okay, so not far. So you are a southwestern United States individual.
Through and through.
And Tucson could be similar to Las Cruces.
Very similar.
A little
similar.
Bit bigger, a little bit.
Yeah.
So we got 1 minute till break. Tell us about Tucson Valley's teachers. Of course, we'll talk a lot about that on the
Yeah, so Tucson Valley's teachers is a nonprofit that our main mission is to elevate the teaching field. And so we do that by supporting and celebrating pre-K teachers up to 12th grade teachers. And, you know, we realize that any teacher, a good teacher impacts their students, and it doesn't matter where those teachers are. So we support all teachers, both public school, charter school, and private school.
Well, and I believe you just had your big annual event, Stand Up for Teachers.
We did.
So when we come back from the break, let's talk about that, some of the other programs you do, and how people can find Tucson Values Teachers. The easiest way, if you want to take a look now, and in case you have a question for us when we come back, TucsonValuesTeachers.org.
Absolutely.
That's the website. Appreciate all you're doing there and everything you've done before. Great opening segment, and I look forward to the listeners staying with us through the bottom of the hour break. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely behind the glass, and Dr. Teresa Hill is with me. Matt, I got to say, in the earlier weather report, you talked about it being blustery and some winds and gusts later this afternoon and chilly, and it has gotten that way, but I was very grateful this morning because when I came off Palo Verde Road and came north.
Yeah.
The huge flag they have at Camping World.
Yes.
Was directly extended and just blowing in the breeze like you see on movies and videos. And I needed that this morning after the drive and the traffic. I mean, the freeway traffic coming eastbound had slowed down to like 30 miles an hour too. So the wind and the chilly, be prepared for it. But I just wanted to throw a shout out to Camping World for having that giant flag. It made my day this morning.
Nice.
So Teresa, great. Like I said, I did not know that much about you until I researched that, which is a foul on me because I've been working with you for so long. An impressive career. And then you got into the nonprofit, supporting your passion, supporting education, supporting teachers.
Yes.
And it led you to Tucson Values Teachers. What was your first thought after you got there and found out all that's involved with the organization?
Yeah, I mean, I was very lucky. You know, when I one thing I've realized is I'm a builder. And so, you know, being in the dance world and building the program from the scratch and opening a principal, I'm a builder. The beauty of getting to come to Tucson Values Teachers is already had such a strong foundation, a strong history. So to get to build on top of that was, you know, really exciting. So, yeah.
So there are several events and several different ways that you highlight and support teachers. But let's just jump into the one you had last week, Stand Up for Teachers. It is the big event you host each year. Can you kind of tell our listeners about it and tell what went into it? And talk to us about some of the things that you got to do at that event.
So Stand Up for Teachers is our biggest annual event. And I like to think of it as the Academy Awards of Pima County for our teachers. And so it's always a great event. But this year was extra special because of the amount of support that we received from the community. Really thankful to O'Reilly Chevrolet, Jim Click Automotives for being our presenting sponsors, Tucson Electric Power for being our reception sponsor. And then of course, Raytheon for being our awards sponsor. If it wasn't for them, we wouldn't even be able to have the award. So, you know, it's a great night. You get to come out, you get to mingle with the crowd, have some drinks, have some live music, just have a great time before we start the event. And then the event is in the Leo Rich Theater. So we all come down into the auditorium and we get to see all of these amazing teachers. So we recognize 12 teachers and they each get their own little limelight. So we give them the red carpet, bring them out individually, and they get to feel the love and the support. So many times their job is thankless. You know, you can go years without hearing like, oh, you made a difference. And so they're just in it and they're in the grind. So this recognition is so important for them to see that the community supports them and appreciates them and loves them. So they get to get up on stage, give them a lot of love. There's four different divisions and three finalists in each division. And we have an awardee that wins significant more money than the others. I mean, they all get some money at the end. So in the end, we have four awardees.
And I think one of the things, it's not just, obviously they appreciate to being recognized, but it's also for their families, because some of these teachers, it's been their lifetime calling. And yeah. And in the past, there's been times that the winners have had to turn down the stipends because it was going to put them in a different income bracket where they would lose more in benefits that they currently receive than the amount of the stipend, which is yeah. a sad statement on what we, you know, pay these teachers even after years in yeah. a lot of cases. But it is a big deal for them, and it's their families get to see them, their coworkers
yes
turn out, and it is a great day of celebration, but it's also a fundraiser.
Absolutely, it's a fundraiser, because the more we can raise from there, the more reach we have for all Southern Arizona teachers. So
what was the moment that you least expected that occurred at Stand Up for Teachers this year?
I mean, I don't know that it's what I least expected, but the best moment is always watching our teachers watch their videos. So we put together a video for each of the 12, and in those videos, they speak, their principal speaks, and their kids speak. And there's nothing like seeing their students get to show the love that they have for them. And so I usually get to be on the side of the stage because I'm running the whole thing, and watching the three teachers stand and watch their videos, there's always tears of gratitude, of appreciation. You can see that they really appreciate. So that's always my favorite moment of the whole thing. And, you know, most of the time when I talk to people, like, oh, I love the video. I mean, I love the event, but the videos, oh my God, the videos.
It's always good to tug at those heartstrings, especially when you're doing a fundraising event too. And this one being your biggest, it kind of sustains you for the year and allows you to do other programs. So,
Absolutely. So
why don't you take a little dive into some of the other programs that you do at Tucson Values Teachers and what impact
yeah.
that they have.
Yeah, you kind of mentioned it. They don't get paid a whole lot, right? And they've got to stretch the dollar. And so a lot of our programs support teachers to help stretch that dollar, things that they would normally pay for out of their pocket. For example, a lot of times they buy supplies for their classroom. So once a year, we have a drive called Tucson Supplies Teachers, and we ask for monetary donations instead of physical donations. And then we turn that money into gift cards so that those teachers can buy the supplies that they need throughout the year. Normally, they'll spend $700 to $800 on average of their own money. So this doesn't cover all of it, but it helps a little bit. Same thing if they want to go to professional development. Maybe they want to go to a conference or a special workshop in an area that they work on. If it's not in the district, it costs them money, and they usually have to pay out of pocket. So we give them scholarships to help cover those so that they can get that professional development. And then we do things to celebrate on top of the Raytheon Leaders Education Award. We also have what we call a Teacher Excellence Award. And we have anybody nominate, and there's no criteria for the teachers. And we go and surprise them once a month. We'll walk into a teacher's classroom, give them $250 cash, $100 gift card for supplies, flowers, and just, you know, make a big deal out of them. Let them see, we see you, we value you, and we appreciate you.
Yeah, I've been part of those, and those can be fun when you do that. Let's go back to the cards you give them, because it used to be TVT did a huge supply drive.
Yeah.
And people would bring and drop stuff off at the SLC in the offices, and you collect it, then you truck it, then you give it out. But you switched to the cards.
Yes.
Could you kind of talk about why and what that does for empowering the teachers to determine what they need?
Yeah, absolutely. When you get the supplies, I can tell you that they're appreciative of anything that they get. And so really for Tucson Values Teachers to switch to a card, it empowers the teachers to buy the things that they need. They know what their classroom needs. They know how long they've been there. They know what their students need. And so it gives that flexibility for them to make the decisions on how best can I use this money. I will tell you that we're very thankful, because last year we partnered with KVOA, and KVOA is continuing the supply part of it. So you can bring physical supplies, and then we take care of the monetary. So together we're able to hit all aspects of the community. If you want to donate something physically, you want to donate money, it's up to you. No problem. We'll take care of it and make sure it gets to the teachers.
So now it must take a big team to do all this work. So how many folks do you have working for you?
Two. Yes.
A little sarcasm. So how can people get involved in helping you in your mission?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, monetary is the easiest way that people can support. People are busy. They've got their own lives, lots of things going on. But you can always donate to Tucson Values Teachers. And, you know, given that there are only two of us, we want to make sure that all of the money that comes in is going to those teachers. And so we are very slim, but we're mighty. We work hard. And that's the first way. The other is volunteering. I can tell you, like the Tucson, the event that we just had, the Stand Up for Teachers, literally, you know, my partner Danica and I, we got all the donations for the raffle, all the donations for the silent auction. We had to make everything, set everything up. We loaded and unloaded. And, you know, thankfully we had some board members that helped us. But man, it's a lot of work. I left that going, oh my God, I'm exhausted. I need help. So you can volunteer.
There's never a shortage of need for volunteers throughout all the majority of the nonprofit world.
Absolutely.
And TVT does run real lean so that you can give the funding and the support you get right back to those that you're trying to help.
Absolutely.
And part of that's because the passion you have from being a teacher and an administrator throughout your life.
Yeah, absolutely. I tell people all the time, you know, first, don't ever forget what it's like to be a teacher, because as long as you can remember that, it's going to steer you in the right way. Second, when I was a principal, I would say, oh yeah, my job is to take care of 60 teachers. Now I feel like my job is to take care of 15,000 plus teachers.
And we could use more. So if you want more information on Tucson Values Teachers, you go to just that, TucsonValuesTeachers.org. A lot of information. When we come back from the break, what I'd like to do is talk about what you see as with, now we're going, I'm going to rely on your experience.
Sure.
What you see is the future of education, the future of the profession, what TVT and others are doing to try to help encourage folks to enter the profession, and what you see is important in the next couple of years.
You got it.
All right. That's the voice of Dr. Teresa Hill, the CEO of Tucson Values Teachers. And we will be back after the break. Stay with us. 10:30 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk. Good morning and welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely's behind the glass. And it's fun to watch Matt always decide what songs he's going to play based on the guest we've got as well. And that's a young Michael Jackson.
Hey, that was a great song.
that we don't want to show our age about when we were around for it.
Well, no, we won't.
No, we don't need to do that. Hope everybody's staying safe out on the roads. There seems to be a few more accidents. Obviously, the one at Miracle Mile must have been pretty significant. The tow trucks were there a little over
still slowing people down.
Half
looks
down.
Like, yep.
So that's something's going on, and who knows. But what we're talking about is Tucson Values Teachers and the support they give to the education community. So you've got a career in education.
Yes.
What's your current assessment of education in our state?
It's scary and bleak, but I have hope 100%. Right. Yeah.
So one of the things seems there's always a challenge for shortage of teachers.
Yes.
Because honestly, we talked about the pay. The pay doesn't always work out well, and it can be challenging times, especially in today's day and age. It seems like it used to be the teachers and the principals and the parents, you know, on the kids. Now it's like the kids and the parents,
yeah,
you know, against the teacher and the principals at times. So that's tough.
Yeah.
How do you think we can get and can encourage people to get involved in the profession?
I mean, ultimately, we all have to change the narrative, first of all. There tends to be such a negative narrative with teachers. For example, because of the pay and because of the stress and the workload, there are many times where a parent will ask a kid, oh, what do you want to be when you grow up? Oh, I want to be a teacher. Oh, no, don't be a teacher. It's too much work. You don't get enough. You don't get paid enough. You know, you have to deal with a lot. And so that's the first thing, is we have to change the narrative to help show that we need our teachers. I mean, without our teachers, our kids are not able to have a positive future. Great teachers make an impact. I can ask you, Ted, think of one teacher that made an impact in your life, and I know somebody pops into your head right away, right? Well, our kids these days need those teachers, because those are the teachers that make a difference, that help develop those kids, that help, you know, make them believe in themselves to be something. And so we've got to understand that their value is worth not just the pay, but everything. You know, we've got to change that. And we have to demand that we fund our education, you know?
Yeah, the funding's obviously always a difficult challenge, that now we're getting into the political world.
Yeah.
Because there's so many things that are competing, the administration, the boards. You know, we were talking offline about your board, but the school boards, you know, folks there aren't getting paid. Some of them have political aspirations, and that's why they're there.
Yeah.
And some don't. It's a difficult situation. So yeah. How's TVT encouraging people or helping people to get involved?
Yeah. Well, obviously, the first thing is just awareness, trying to bring awareness to what the realities of teaching is. We have a program called Principal for a Day, and we bring in business leaders and community members to get to spend 3 hours with the principal. And we ask the principals to just have a normal day. If you're dealing with discipline, if you have a parent meeting, if you have a budget meeting, take them with you to those things. Don't clear your calendar for them. And man, it's eye-opening for those guests that come and go, oh my God, school does not look like it used to when I went to school. So that's the first thing, is bringing that awareness.
Now you've done that program, I believe, at Sahuarita School District the last couple of years?
Yeah, well, we did it at Sahuarita the first year. Last year we went to Vail.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So try to do different.
So you've hit
districts.
Two pretty strong districts.
Yeah.
You know, and we've talked a lot about Flowing Wells. That's where you grew up. And for Flowing Wells, for them being such a migratory district where people move in and out because a lot of rental space, a lot of other things, it's also an extremely successful school district.
Yes.
Sometimes I hate to say it, but we need to show the things that aren't going as well to get people to really get engaged and get involved.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's just having conversations with different people. I actually have been in conversations with Sunnyside and Jose Gastelum to see if, you know, maybe we can go there. Obviously, I have talked to Flowing Wells because I have a relationship with them. But, yeah, trying to show all aspects of that are important because those challenges are real that they face.
And then when it comes down to boots on the ground of helping create more teachers.
Yeah.
I believe you have a program.
Yeah, we just started our Future Educator Scholarship. Happy to say that last May we had six teachers or future teachers receive the award scholarship. They were all high school seniors who graduated and knew that they wanted to be teachers. So the way the scholarship works is they get $1,000 renewable for 3 more years so that we're supporting them a little bit as they're going through school. But the biggest piece is that they get a mentor. So one of the Raytheon Leaders in Education awardees is a mentor to them. And as they're going through school, they stay in touch with them at least once a month, invite them into their classroom to volunteer, just build a relationship with them and have a classroom that those kids can go to while they're going to school.
Well, it's a challenge. There's no doubt. I think everybody remembers the teachers in their lives.
Yeah.
Some more fondly, some not so fondly, but those are generally our own problems because they've had to crack down on us.
Absolutely.
I know I've got a couple teachers that I remember that kind of steered me in the direction I went. So
yeah.
Thank you for all you're doing.
Of course.
For Tucson Values Teachers.
I got to throw in a plug
for the community.
For our website. We just developed a platform. It's called Lumia, and it is free for teachers. And in January, we're going to be opening up to all teachers. So keep an eye out for that.
All right. Take a look at, can they find more information about that on the website?
Absolutely.
All right. Tucson Teachers, TucsonValuesTeachers.org. You can find that there and you find other information. Thank you, Dr. Hill, for being with us today. I appreciate all your work.
Appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. The next hour is about water. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice, Tuesday edition, civic engagement, about trying to get everyone involved. We had a good hour with Dr. Teresa Hill, running Tucson Values Teachers. That organization was started with a business entity aspect in mind, and it's continued to go on and make improvements and add a lot to this community. So it's a great opportunity if you Tucson Values Teachers.org if you want more information. And now we're going to go into a little bit of conversation on water. So Matt, you sent me an article yesterday that you wanted to talk about, and it's water related. So
it's water related. Sure.
Perfect time to consider it, but it kind of talks about, I think it leads into this whole discussion on water, of why water is such an issue.
It does a bit. Also, there we go. Also, it also feathers back into a discussion we've had about the the protesters that we had at Project Blue and some of the tactics that are used. So the Green Valley Community Water Company was going to have a little meeting to discuss low-flow toilets and how to fix leaky pipes and, you know, wrap your pipes and this kind of thing. You know, just water conservation, home tips. They said the last time they did one of these, they had two attendees. And one of them stumbled into the meeting by accident and decided to stay for it. This is, it's a regulatory meeting they're required to have. They did public notice. They ran ads. They said, we're having a meeting to discuss water conservation tips at home, period. Okay, so the Save the Scenic Santa Rita's organization took the opportunity to send out mailers and somehow place advertisements, according to the Green Valley News. I'll use the word hijack. You know, they'll probably argue that, but they, you know, they wanted to turn the meeting into a forum on Copper World. And so they had 120 people show up to a meeting that usually gets one, two, or maybe a handful. And they tried to shift the meeting. And, you know, they told all these people that attended that this meeting was to talk about Copper World. Okay. So the Save the Scenic Santa Rita's, you know, tried to take over this meeting. They had, once they hit 60-person capacity for the library where it was being held, they had to turn people away, and then everybody's upset because they came out and they think they're, something's being hidden from them, right? And they put the poor director for this community water company who thinks he's going to go talk about low-flow shower heads, you know, and using drip irrigation instead of flood irrigation, and he gets swamped with all these people. This poor guy's just going out doing his job. It turns into a bit of a testy exchange with him kind of getting a little bit testy because he was completely caught off guard and they're trying to put him on the spot. What are your political views? Do you support the mine? Does this, well, the upshot of the whole thing is the Community Water Company of Green Valley, and good for Green Valley News for reporting this. They have nothing to do with Copper World. They don't service it. They don't provide the water to it. They don't have any regulatory authority. They have nothing, zero to do with it. But these people wanted to go out, and it's just like we saw here with the Project Blue things, where people just come in and want to take over a meeting and make it about their political agenda.
Oh, there's absolutely, that's true. And if you know, I know Arturo Gabaldon pretty well. He's the husband of Senator Gabaldon, representing that district down there, and they're both very water conscious, very supportive of good use of water or anything. And for him to get frustrated because he's just a happy-go-lucky guy, I was glad they showed the picture of him laughing later
in
the meeting.
By the end of it, he realized the absurdity of the situation, and he said, "Hey, look, I got wound up about this," but he said, "Hey, look, I have views about the mine too." He didn't say what they were, but he says, "I have my own views about the mine. That's not what this meeting is about."
Right.
Right.
And this goes back, and you mentioned it. We talked about it during Project Blue. It's called mass takeovers on these conversations.
Right.
And the one thing I'll give the group crowd here, once he got started, once they calmed down and let him get started, they all went, "Oh, this is pretty decent information," so they at least listened to him.
Right.
But the people out in the parking lot who were making the scene, who got the attention of the paper, the first goes back to the conversation we had on the First Amendment rights. Your First Amendment rights are to voice your opinion, but it's not to drown out other people's opinions, right. And it's not to take over public meetings.
Well, and the spokesgal, and I can't remember the spokesperson for the Save the Scenic Santa Rita's, but or whatever, but she says, "Well, you know, they haven't made a statement. They haven't, the Community Water Company has not come out and taken a stand on the mine. Was it really their job?"
So now you're
going to force people, right, to swear some sort of loyalty oath to your cause? I mean, you know, look at all the conversation about the President of the United States, you know, and they're doing the same tactics.
It's true. There's no doubt. And I think the Community Water Company of Green Valley is one of like six down there, and none of them are supplying the mines.
Yeah,
because they're pretty predominantly well. And he even in the article, Arturo Gabaldon said, "Listen, Copper World's got their access. They've got their own mines. They've got their own waste.
Plus, wells.
Plus, they're trying to pay so that they can bring the CAP water farther down to Green Valley. So, in other words, investment in the community so we can make better use of the waters we do have."
Yeah.
Now, that being said,
stopped on the way home and bought a bunch of pecans.
Yeah.
All the 120 people that attended the meeting.
Thought you might
oblivious
go there.
To their own, you know.
But I see we've got Ted Cook with us. And so let's bring him on the air. Good morning, Ted. How are you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing great.
So I guess
how
this,
are you?
Doing well. I guess this will be the Ted and Ted show, but we'll go there with it.
Ted Talk.
Ted Talk. True TED Talk. There it is. Mr. Cook, I appreciate you being with us. I've had the opportunity to work with you for quite a while, and you are what I call one of the icons of water knowledge surrounding the Colorado River. And we kind of set up the conversation coming in with the discussion of water is now a topic on everything that happens in a community. We've seen it down here with the data centers. We've seen it now with the mines. Everything comes back to water. So I appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So for those who do not know or may not have heard of Ted Cook before, you were the general manager for the Central Arizona Project for a long time. You joined CAP in 99, left CAP just a handful of years ago. So over 20 years, you were at the core of the Colorado River, and you've been through some incredibly challenging times. I had the first time I really got to work with you was when I was on the Drought Contingency Plan Committee, and you held over 40 meetings, sub-meetings. You did everything to help bring us to a solution of what we could do for the drought contingency plan. Could you just give, before we go into the details of that, could you kind of give the listeners a little background on how you got involved in water?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. And I'll just clarify one thing. I was a general manager at CAP for just shy of 8 years, but I did work there for 24 years. So before that, I was basically the chief financial officer. And we'll get a little bit into that. So how did I come to work at CAP and get, as you said, get into water? And boy, did I get into it once I got into it. I grew up in Southern California. I went to school and got a physics degree and an MBA in operations. I wanted to work for a technical company. So Xerox was a big company in the Los Angeles area. That's what I did. I was intended to be an industrial engineer, but something got goofed up with my hiring paperwork and they put me in a finance job. And I called myself the accidental accountant.
That's outstanding.
Sounds like a podcast name.
I did eventually get finance and accounting actual certifications. And it was a fortuitous mistake because finance became the lingua franca of my career after that. And while I was at Xerox, I did do some work as an engineering program manager as well. But I got tired of the big corporate experience, and I felt I was going to be getting farther and farther away from what they were actually doing and just putting, you know, communicating something that somebody below me in the organization sent me and summarizing that and sending it on to the next person. So I wanted to work for a smaller company, and without really targeting this type of business, I ended up at a commercial scale solar power company called Luz International. It was a pioneer solar thermal power company. That's with these parabolic troughs, not PV panels. And worked there, and boy, did I get hooked on the utility experience with the big infrastructure and the doing something important and visible in the community and things like that. That company built 9 plants and ended up going bankrupt, even though the project still operated. So I moved to a similar company that was doing geothermal also in California and Oregon. And that company was divested. And so once again, I was on the prowl for a job and ended up very, very fortunately, and I'm very grateful for a headhunter pointing me toward CAP. It was a utility. I was relying on my finance experience, and that's why I got hired in that role at CAP. But I had done other things while I was at these other jobs, such as O&M and development and project development and things like that. So that eventually, in all my experience at CAP, that's really what led me to the general manager role there.
Well, I think that that was a great outcome for us, and it obviously was, I think, a great outcome for you. You talk about a journey that wasn't necessarily a straight path, or what I remind people of all the time, it wasn't what you planned on when you started.
Right, right. But it worked out pretty well, I think. For me, certainly personally, despite all the disruption and everything with those private power companies, I learned more so much there that I would actually do it again if I had to.
So there's a lot that goes on to the Colorado River, and obviously we want to talk about that, but I don't know how many people know the history about how far back the Colorado Compact and when it began. Can you give us a little history on the original compact and how that has played into the last 20 years?
Sure. I will try and explain that briefly, but it's very complicated. And there's a body of laws and contracts and court precedents and practices that is referred to collectively as the law of the river. And one of the key pieces of the law of the river, referring to the Colorado River, is the 1922 Colorado River Compact among the seven states in the Colorado River Basin. And among other things, what that compact did is it divided the waters of the Colorado River between the four upper basin states and the three lower basin states, which are Arizona, California, and Nevada. And there were many, many other agreements since 1922. It's been over 100 years since then, including the treaty with Mexico in 1944. There was a compact among the four upper basin states amongst themselves. There was a long lawsuit called Arizona versus California that took decades to get through the Supreme Court that clarified some differences of opinion between Arizona and California, and it goes on and on and on. As far as today goes, the next, I guess, notable thing that I would refer to would be the 2007 interim guidelines. And this is a rules for operations of the Colorado River that were put into place by the Bureau of Reclamation, the Department of the Interior in 2007, and were supposed to last for 20 years. So two key things about that. The 20 years is just about up because it's 2026 next year. And so we need a new set of guidelines. But our experience during the 2007 guidelines was that as ambitious as they were, they did not cover all of the scenarios that we eventually experienced, particularly with respect to climate change and drought, hotter and drier climate, and a lot less water than the Colorado River Compact and these other agreements contemplated. So you mentioned earlier that you were a member of the Drought Contingency Plan Committee in Arizona, and that Drought Contingency Plan came together in 2019. It was worked on for several years before that, probably starting in late 2015, and took 3+ years to get across the finish line. This is just one example, probably the most notable example of, I'll call it an amendment to or an overlay to the 2007 guidelines. And there have been several more since then. And now the seven states and everybody else is working on the next set of guidelines to follow the current set, which does expire. It goes away. And so we're left with some operating criteria that were put into place in the 70s. And nobody wants to go back to that because that is really way far away from the current conditions that we're dealing with.
And Ted, this is a great spot to take a, well, let us go to a break right now, because I want to come back and talk a little bit about the DCP, because I thought that was a big move. And for the listeners who aren't aware, the four upper basin states are Utah, Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico. And for the rest of our conversation, there's going to be a lot of discussion between the difference between the lower basin states and the upper basin states and their current positions. So, Ted, appreciate you being with us. We'll be right back after the break. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell, Matt Neely behind the glass. And with us is Ted Cook, the former general manager of the Central Arizona Project, currently a board member on the Water Infrastructure Financing Authority, and we'll get into WIFA a little bit later. But Ted, appreciate you given us all that history. That was actually, I learned from the things you were saying, and I hope the listeners did as well. And you mentioned 2007. That was the agreement that set things in place that are now about to expire at the end of 2026. And there's been negotiations throughout that time because we've entered a drought that I don't think was predicted, and it wasn't definitely predicted in 2007 with those results. So you'd started talking about the lower basin. I think it's important. It's only the lower basin efforts on the drought contingency plan to try to keep water in Lake Mead and therefore hopefully water in Lake Powell. And if you want, can you give us just a little insight to the importance of that and the importance of those two lakes? And sir, we have a hard break at the bottom of the hour. So at 8:29:50, okay, we have to go. We have no choice.
Okay. All right, I'll try and squeeze that into that space. So as I mentioned earlier this morning, that the drought contingency plan was probably the most prominent overlay to the 2007 guidelines because those guidelines were proving to be inadequate to deal with the hydrological experiences on the Colorado River. There was less water, hotter and drier temperatures, et cetera. And so the focus, as you mentioned, primarily was how do we keep the two major reservoirs, Lake Powell and Lake Mead, from becoming too empty such that they wouldn't be able to operate and we couldn't, in the extreme, wouldn't be able to get water past the dam because they were so low. And so the drought contingency plan, the solution to that was, well, we need to do more of what the 2007 guidelines were doing. We need to take bigger cuts than were included in the 2007 guidelines. This is reductions in deliveries to the lower basin states. And needed to do that, in hindsight, at higher elevations in the two lakes. So needed to do it sooner and do more going forward. Well, by the time the drought contingency plan came into place in 2019, a lot of years had gone by, so we couldn't go back and fix what, in hindsight, hadn't been enough, but we certainly could do more going forward. And then we had to do a little bit more and then a little bit more. I'll call it the easy part, even though it wasn't easy. No easier, I think, than what is going on right now on the next set of guidelines among the seven states, which was the easy part was getting to some kind of agreement among the three lower basin states as far as how much were we going to cut and who was going to take it. And we were able to do that actually in a few months in 2015 and 16. It was not easy. And the backbone of doing that kind of work is modeling, looking at the hydrological models and predictions based on the past and the probabilities in the future. And always asking the question, what will be enough? What happens if we do this? And this is going to save us enough. And if not, let's tweak it. And then the hard work became going back to our individual states and trying to find a way to implement each state's piece of the plan, of the drought contingency plan, within the state. And that was the reason for that committee that you served on, Ted, was trying to get consensus within Arizona about how to do that. And that was not easy. But we got that done as well. It's an example, I think, of the way things ought to work going forward. We learned a lot of lessons doing that. But the primary lesson is that you always need to keep your eye on what actually needs to be done and make that your goal rather than let's stop when we get to the point of doing something. Because more often than not, the something that we end up agreeing to do is not going to be enough, and we're going to have to come back and do it again. And that's one of the major goals, I think, for this next set of guidelines is to avoid the mistakes of the past and do what needs to be done, as hard as it might be, and don't give up until we get there. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of time to do that.
And I think you bring up a great point with that. It's been a continual negotiation in its lifetime. Now, one of the things I thought was significant about DCP is for the first time, California also agreed to give up water. I don't know if all Arizonans understand our junior status.
That's right. In 1968, when the Central Arizona Project was approved by Congress, one of the things that Arizona had to agree to was to take a junior position on the river to California so that California would get water first in the event of a shortage, and then Arizona would come. So technically, California did not have to do that, but they did because they realized the criticality of the situation on the river and that everybody had to help.
And technically, under the current negotiations, are the upper basin states required to take a cut?
They're not required to take a cut right now. And as a matter of fact, the lower basin states, so once the current guidelines expire, are not required to take a cut.
Okay.
It goes, as I said, back to the long-term operating criteria that were put in place in the 70s, where those ideas of mandatory cuts coming from the feds was more of a high-level concept than specific prescription for who had to do what and based on which parameters.
So when we come back after the bottom of the hour break, we'll talk a little bit more about the impact of Lake Mead and Powell and the role they play, as well as what potentially could happen if we can't come up with a solution. So I appreciate the voice of Ted Cook, former general manager of the Central Arizona Project and a true Colorado River water expert. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Don't know if that's a musician that many of you recognize. It was huge back in the 70s.
Jerry Riopel, baby. He was just lighting it up in the Valley and in Tucson. He would come down here and play. And okay. I don't have too many opportunities to play it. So, I mean, it's a stretch fitting it into the water theme today, but we do what we can.
Well, Matt, I think, you know, back then, obviously, Jerry believed that there was enough water in Arizona that he could walk on it. So it was it was an opportunity.
You know, Ted, Arizona at one time, I don't know if it's still the case, has the largest number of boats per capita in the country. But I think that may be an old statistic when we had a relatively lower population.
Well, I appreciate that coming up because that does lead into the next conversation. So Ted Cook's with me. He's the former general manager of Central Arizona Project and currently a board member of the Water Infrastructure Financing Authority of Arizona, which we'll get to in the last segment, because I appreciate you staying with us, Ted, for the remainder of the hour. I've been learning a lot, and I thought I know a little bit about water, but nothing compared to what you know and what you're sharing. So I appreciate your time.
Good to be here.
If we could you just give a quick synopsis of why, I want to get into the further negotiations, but why are the levels of Lake Mead and the levels of Lake Powell so important and such an indicator on the state of the Colorado River?
Sure. Well, as we mentioned earlier this morning, that Lake Mead and Lake Powell are the two largest reservoirs on the Colorado River system by an order of magnitude, at least, from the other smaller reservoirs. Lake Powell is basically at the bottom of the lower basin. I'm sorry, the upper basin. So the upper basin states, Colorado, Wyoming, New Mexico, and Utah is where the Colorado River tributaries, most of the snowpack occurs there and the runoff from the snowpack, and it collects in Lake Powell. It's at the bottom of the upper basin system, basically. There's no way to get water that comes in Lake Powell, obviously, to go back up upstream. And so the upper basin uses what they can on the ground, and then the rest goes into Lake Powell. And then Lake Powell releases water into Lake Mead, just on the other side of the Grand Canyon, basically at the top of the lower basin system. And Lake Mead releases water then to the three lower basin states. So the elevation of those two lakes right now, each of them are somewhere around 30% full. They were nearly full in the year 2000, both of them, and have declined to this point over that period of time of about 25 years because of a number of factors, primarily climate change, less precipitation, less runoff from what does come from snow because the ground is dry and warm and soaks up that water instead of it running into the reservoirs. And In the view of many folks, and I tend to agree with part of this, overuse by such things as not taking into account the evaporation in the lakes and things like that, and the basin states are coming to terms with those kind of things, but these lake levels are the canary in the coal mine. They were used in the 2007 guidelines, and they may well be used in the next set of guidelines as also the triggers for when cuts need to be taken. Reductions in the existing levels of use may determine where cuts need to be taken. But they're at pretty frighteningly low levels right now. 30% sounds like, well, it's a lot less than 100, but it's not zero. And it's not zero. But there start to be some difficulties when the lakes get this low, such as both Glen Canyon Dam and Hoover Dam at Lake Powell and Lake Mead, respectively, are huge power generators for the Southwest. And the ability to produce power depends largely on the head in the lake, the height of the water, the weight of the water pressing down and going through the dam and generating electricity. And the lower the water is, the less electricity can be generated. And believe it or not, the amount of electricity, while it's really, really important to a lot of people, is secondary, both under the law of the river and elsewhere, to the ability to get water past the dam. So I won't go into a lot of detail, but basically, if you look at the reliability of Glen Canyon Dam in particular, and other water that's mostly in Lake Mead that belongs to somebody because they have paid to conserve water in the lake, and you deduct those amounts from what is actually in the lake, we basically only have a year's worth of water in Lake Powell and Lake Mead. It's around 7 million acre feet. And that's about the level that the lower basin states in Mexico are using in the last couple of years. So what if we have a bad winter? What if we're not able to replenish in those lakes from what falls from the sky to replenish what we use, and the lakes go even lower? It's a very dire situation right now.
And you make such a great point there, because one of the ways we've propped up those levels is by letting people store or keep their water. And water law is something I don't want to get into. It is one of the most complex and confusing water rights, credits, a whole bunch of other things. But what I would want to make sure the listeners are aware of is you were nominated by President Trump to become the chair or the lead of the Bureau of Reclamation, who's the part of the Interior Department that oversees what happens with the Colorado River. Long story short, I think that concerned the senators and some of the members of Congress from some of the upper basin states, particularly Colorado and Utah. And eventually, President Trump pulled back. Many of us thought you were the perfect one because of both your approach and because of your knowledge of the Colorado River. I get their concern that you were from Arizona. But now that you're not going to be the one having to moderate that, what do you think the next steps are going to be, and what if you were in that position, what would you have done to try to get the upper basin states and the lower basin states to come to a solution?
Right. That is really a loaded question, but I'll try to answer it the best I can. For a long time, most folks that work in this arena, Colorado River, would agree that having an agreement among the seven states, both the upper basin and the lower basin, is the preferable way to move forward. And that's because these records of decision that the Department of the Interior needs to make to put these kind of guidelines into place requires an extensive public vetting process, including an environmental impact statement. And so it's easier, I think, going in with the agreements from the seven states that everybody's on the same page to prevent lawsuits and have other people with a starting point to get on board, even though, as I mentioned earlier on the 2007 guidelines, that's not easy either to get each state's plan together without objection. There was a recent deadline here this past week, last week, that came and went without a lot of hoopla, except among water people. And it was the seven states have been working together to try and come up with an agreement for the post-2026 guidelines for over a year and a half, and without a whole lot of progress. And the central issues are how much reduction in the current level of use do we need to make collectively in the Colorado River Basin, and who's going to take it. And then subordinate to that would be, okay, how do we manage the releases from Lake Powell to Lake Mead, and based on what criteria? And of course, that's very important, because once water gets into Lake Powell, there's only one place for it to go, which is down into the lower basin. They passed the deadline on November 11th. It was to have a preliminary agreement in place among the seven states. That didn't happen. The next day, on November 12th, there was there was a joint statement, actually on the 11th, from the seven states in reclamation that had some a word salad about, well, we've made considerable progress in our talks and we're going to keep talking. And everybody then who observed that said they passed the deadline and they didn't meet the deadline. So what happens next? And the next day, some additional comments came out and said, oh, we really did meet the deadline. We decided to keep talking. So that indicates that we believe we've made enough progress so far that we can check the box on November 11th and move on to the next deadline, which is February. It's a bunch of malarkey. They passed the deadline. They didn't meet it. So that gives everyone a lot less confidence that they're actually going to make the next deadline or take up important time that they should be using to do something else, like start the EIS process or flesh out the draft agreement that they were supposed to have had on November 11th by February 26th. And this is the history on the Colorado River, is that deadlines are set, they're passed, they keep going and try to do more, but there always seems to be more time. Well, there is no more time now. We've got the deadline September 30th of next year, where the new guidelines have to be in place, and there is no plan B. There has to be a set of guidelines, or we go back to these archaic criteria from 4 years ago.
And if we go back,
it's easy.
Go ahead, Ted.
It's easy to look back and say, well, what would you do, Ted, if you had become the Commissioner of Reclamation? And I will say, other than my personal disappointment, I think it's a real shame that this type of politics has intruded on, and this is not red and blue politics, this is upper basin, lower basin politics, has intruded on this whole process, and not for the good. But there are ways, I think, short of Reclamation stepping in and saying, okay, you guys aren't getting anywhere, we're going to impose what we, the federal government, thinks needs to happen. And that always is an option for them to do that. But they want to avoid it for the reasons I already mentioned, is that it's better to have the states on the same page. But they're not getting there. So in my mind, there needs to be some type of arbitration, not in the legal sense of hiring arbitrators and things like that, but having the United States be the arbitrators, where it only moves in one way. You can't walk away from the arbitration, and involves, you know, putting each side basically in the shoes of their opponents. It's a strong word, but that's really what's going on. And saying, if your point of view was not something that we would be moving forward with, how would you put together a set of guidelines? And ask the opposite side the other thing, and try to come to some kind of agreement. I have my own personal ideas about that. There needs to be sharing of reductions in both the upper and the lower basin. The upper basin doesn't want to do it because they have never taken the whole amount of water that has been apportioned to them under the compact. But that's largely because that water does not fall from the sky. There's nothing for them to take. So they take what they can. The rest goes into Lake Powell. And they have said, we're not taking cuts because we're already taking cuts. But to me, a reduction in an existing use is a lot different than just not having the precipitation in the first place.
Absolutely. And I think that's a great point. And I appreciate all that you've filled our listeners in on. It's going to be tough. I do want to go to a break here so that when we come back, we can have a little more positive conversation. And that's your role with the Water Infrastructure Finance Authority. I know you've got a meeting in a couple of days, but I'd love you to just inform the listeners at that point on what is possible to help address some of the water issues we've got in our state right now.
Great. Thank you.
All right. We'll be right back. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I'm Ted Maxer, your host today. Please join Grant Kruger, your host in the morning. Amongst his guests will be David Bosie, the RNC National Committee MD and President of Citizens United. So join in to Grant. He's always got a good, brisk conversation going on. My guest this hour has been Ted Cook, a board member for the Water Infrastructure Financing Authority, and as I've said multiple times, an expert on the Colorado River. Ted, I appreciate you right up front, because the end always gets hectic. I want to say thank you for your time today. I've learned a lot. I'm sure our listeners have learned a lot, and this problem's far from over.
That's right. But as you mentioned at the end of the last segment, that the work that WIFA is doing is, I think, very important for the future. I know it's very important for the future. And in hindsight, of course, we should have been doing these types of things more vigorously in the past. We didn't just start doing these type of things just a couple of years ago, but they've really taken off. WIFA, again, is the Water Infrastructure Finance Authority of Arizona. It's been around since the 1980s in Arizona, primarily responsible for administering clean water and drinking water programs funded primarily by the federal EPA. But in 2022, the legislature gave some additional authorities to WIFA that included conservation, rural water supply development, and what we're going to talk about next, water augmentation. And I happen to be, as a board member for WIFA, also the chair of the Long-Term Water Augmentation Committee for WIFA. And there's a lot going on right now with that. There's some dollars that were appropriated by the legislature, and there's more to talk about maybe another time on that. And there is a water importation program, bringing water from out of state. And then there's a smaller in-state water augmentation program that is authorized by the statutes. On the water importation project from out of state, tomorrow is a very important WIFA board meeting where there are a number of projects that have been recommended by the committee that I mentioned for the consideration by the board to approve I'll call it a pre-development contract. With several teams that have proposed water importation projects. It's taken about a year and a half to get to this point with a procurement solicitation, and tomorrow will be the big decision about which, if any, of these projects are going to move forward. On the other side, the smaller in-state water augmentation program, last month the board approved a funding cycle for that, and just this week, I think yesterday, the guidelines and the application packages for that funding cycle have just been published. So it's very, very exciting. Augmentation, new water supplies is what is clearly needed due to cutbacks on our existing supplies like the Colorado River. In the meantime, what we're going to have to rely on is ongoing conservation and also reuse. There still is a lot that we can do. It's not in the magnitude that will replace the loss of Colorado River water and other sources of water, but it's what we need to do to get by, and we're going to have to tighten the belt. It's going to be painful, but that's what we need to do until these new water supplies come along in the next 10 years or so. But I'm convinced that these things are going to happen, not just because we need to, but because we've got the best minds in Arizona working on it.
Well, and that includes yours, and I appreciate it. I've worked on the long-range augmentation with you in the past. Love to have you back. We've still got about another minute. What's the last thought you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Well, we've used words in this interview and so forth, like a dire situation, and we're only 1 year away from a catastrophe, and things like that. It is dire, but people should not be frightened or think Arizona is out of water. We have less than we need. We're going to use less than we've used. But Arizona has traditionally been a leader in the water arena. And we'll continue to do that. So even though it will be tough in the short term, water will become scarcer and more expensive in the interim. But like I said, we've got the best people working on this. We've made lots of contingency plans to help get us through the tough spots, but no one should conclude that Arizona is running out of water or anything
that. And Tom, we've got to jump, and I greatly appreciate your time today, and you are one of those experts. Thank you, and everybody.
Okay, listen. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, Tom. I look forward to it again. Listen to The Morning Voice.
Okay, thank you.